1905 was a landmark year for the scientific community. In 1905, a young scientist who had just received his PhD published four papers, and each of these papers represented a scientific breakthrough of tremendous proportions, each in a different area of study. The first paper was on the photoelectric effect and led to modern-day quantum theory. The second paper was on Brownian motion and explained the evidence for modern atomic theory. The third paper was on special relativity, and the fourth paper was on matter-energy equivalence and expressed that most famous equation, E equals MC squared. In case you haven't already figured it out, that young scientist was Albert Einstein. That year has been called Einstein's Annus Mirabilis, I think. That's miracle year in Latin. In one year, Einstein made four breakthroughs in four different areas of study that each would have been a lifetime achievement for any other scientist. The scientific community at the time was stuck. They were unable to understand the data they had, unable to see a way forward, unsure even of the questions they should have been asking. They couldn't see a way out. They were at a dead end. And after a long period of being stuck, Einstein came along and wrote four papers that dropped like a bomb. And that blast of that bomb is still being felt today. There's something about scientific breakthroughs and discoveries that's just exciting. There's something about seeing somebody confront an obstacle, something that's hard to get over, a hump, and getting over that hump that is exciting. But there are obstacles that are more difficult and more important than scientific obstacles. Today we're going to look at three obstacles and see three breakthroughs. And each of these breakthroughs led the way to the greatest event in history, to the cross of Jesus. And as we look at these breakthroughs, I'd like us to ask, how do I need God to break through in my life? All of us need God to break through in our lives in some way. For some of us, we know, or at least we think we know, what we need God to do. But more often, we're oblivious to the breakthrough we truly need. So let's be open to him showing us today. As Genesis 37 draws to a close, Joseph was sold as a slave in Egypt. And we're left with some questions. What's going to become of him? Will we ever see him again? Does he still have a role to play in God's covenant people? And how is God going to work through this clearly dysfunctional family to bring about his blessing to the entire world? And instead of answering these questions, the biblical text moves on to a seemingly unrelated story about Joseph's brother, Judah. Now, I'm going to warn you, this passage is complicated and it has a lot that needs to be explained. So here's the game plan. We're going to start by just talking through the passage. We're going to go through the passage and talk through the story together. And then after we've talked through the story, we're going to come back and we're going to see three points, three breakthroughs. First, we'll see a breakthrough in the young woman named Tamar's life. Then we'll see a breakthrough in Judah's life. And finally, we'll see a breakthrough in the life of their child. So, if you're not already there, open to Genesis 38. Let's get started. Judah is one of Jacob's sons, and he's the one who in the previous chapter suggested that instead of killing Joseph, they get something out of it and sell him into slavery. Not a very loyal guy. And it's important to note Judah's place in the family line. Judah is Jacob's fourth son. Now, his older brothers have all acted shamefully and disgracefully. Reuben, the oldest, usurped his father's authority by sleeping with his father's concubine, Bilhah, in Genesis 35:22. Ever since then, he's been completely ineffectual as a leader. Simeon and Levi were the two who overreacted and slaughtered every man in the city of Shechem after Dinah was raped. And so they are disqualified as leaders of the family. So that brings us to Judah. He's next in line for the birthright. But he's going the wrong direction. Look with me at what it says in Genesis 38:1. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hurah. It says Judah went down from his brothers. And as we'll see, his geographical descent mirrors his spiritual descent. Hurah, he went to hang out with this guy named Hurah. And you can bet that with a name like Hurah, this guy was a partier. Hurah was an Adullamite, which meant he lived in the Canaanite city of Adullam. And Judah starts hanging out with this unsavory guy, a Canaanite, the people that God warned them to not be hanging out with, not to intermingle with. And he also meets an unsavory woman whom he marries. Now, from the text, it appears that this is more of a case of lust at first sight than love at first sight. Every reference to this woman has a sexual connotation. Look at how it's worded in verse 2. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. And she conceived again and bore a son and called his name Onan. And yet again, she bore a son and called his name Shelah. Now notice that this woman is never even named. We don't know what she's named. In fact, there's no mention of any relationship between her and Judah outside of their sexual relationship. So Judah's hanging out with pagan Canaanites, and he has a Canaanite wife. Now, this is exactly the situation that Abraham, his great-granddad, and Isaac, his grandfather, would have been appalled at. Look what it says in Genesis 28:1. It should come up on here. Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, "You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women." Then Genesis 24:3, back when in Abraham's case, I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of Canaanites among whom I dwell. You see, God knew that if Israel intermarried with the Canaanites, they would become corrupt. And that's exactly what happens to Judah's family. Judah has three sons, Ur, Onan, and Shelah. And we'll see their corruption and wickedness in the next few verses. Read with me in verse 6. It says, "And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death." Now, we don't know much about Ur, other than the fact that he was wicked, he married Tamar, and God put him to death. That's his claim to fame. That's his legacy. And this is the first time in the Bible where God singles someone out to be put to death. Now, you may be thinking that we don't like that idea of God putting someone to death. That sounds like God's mean and angry. Well, our God is a big God, and he gets angry at sin. And although he's also merciful and loving, he is a perfect judge. And God judges people with death sometimes. You may be thinking, well, that's only in the Old Testament that God's like that. Well, I've got news for you. God is the same. He doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. In fact, in the New Testament, we see at least two examples of God putting people to death for their sin. First, we see the example of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts, where God judges them because of a lie about the amount of an offering they gave, and they die. Then later in 1 Corinthians, we see that some people in Corinth had died because they were abusing the Lord's Supper. God is a God who judges sin. He's not the pacifist hippie that sometimes we imagine him to be. So Ur's dead. Now, in this culture, there was a custom that seems extremely foreign to us. And this custom is called the Levirate marriage law. The Levirate marriage law said that if a man gets married and dies without having any children, then the father of the dead husband had the obligation to be the defender and the provider for that widow. And if he had any other sons, he had the obligation to provide a husband for her. Later, this is written into the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy 25. It says, If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed him in the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. Now, I know this custom seems extremely strange to us, but we have to remember that this culture was very, very, very different from our culture. This was a culture in which arranged marriages were the norm, and where when a woman married a man, she was joining her husband's tribe, and by doing so, she became the responsibility of the leader of that tribe. So Tamar marries Ur, and when he dies, she becomes Judah's responsibility, because Judah is the leader of that tribe. And we tend to think of this practice as barbaric and primitive. But the truth is, most of these marriages worked out. Before we knock other cultural practices, maybe we should think about how marriage is doing in our culture. Today, in the U.S., about 50% of marriages end in divorce. So we have our own issues with marriage. So part of the purpose of this Levirate marriage law was that a woman would be provided a child so that their husband's name would continue on. And what that meant was that the first son produced would bear the name of that dead husband, and so would be thought of and reckoned as belonging to that dead husband. And as such, this son would receive his father's portion of the inheritance. Now, this could cause some trouble, because what this meant was that the brother was fathering a child that would effectively further divide his own portion of the inheritance. So after Ur dies, Judah fulfills his obligation and gives Tamar to his second son, Onan, as a husband. And wouldn't you know it, Onan is an evil man as well. Maybe Abraham and Isaac were onto something about listening to God about not intermarrying with those Canaanites. Read with me in verse 8. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go and your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went to his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as to not give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. I know what you're thinking. Yes, I just said semen in a sermon. I wasn't talking about a sailor. Onan was an evil man. And so he goes in and uses this obligation to gratify his own sensual desires in a way that meant he didn't have to be committed to Tamar. You see, he was using Tamar for his own pleasure, but he was doing so in a way that he didn't have to assume any responsibility or obligation to her. You see, in the Bible, God tells us that there is a place for sex, and that place is within a committed marriage relationship where there has been a public commitment with one another. Only once there has been a public commitment is there to be a private consummation. And in fact, that's what marriage is biblically. It's a public commitment followed by a private consummation. And that commitment creates a safe space for sexuality to reach its divine intended goal. You see, God designed sex and marriage and children to go together. I know that sounds crazy, but they go together. So the moral equivalent of this today in our culture would be a guy who's sleeping with his girlfriend and tells her to take the pill or uses a condom because they don't want to have to get married and have a baby. This would be the equivalent of a woman getting pregnant and having an abortion because her and her boyfriend don't want the burden of a child. This is the guy who gets married and loves his wife, but when she says, I think we should start a family, he says he's not interested in ever having children. No, I think you should keep working to pay the bills, and I got a lot of hobbies, and I don't want to be tied down. Now, I have to be extremely careful here to spell out what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that the only purpose of sex is having children. God designed sex for our mutual pleasure. And it's one way he's allowed us to be able to give each other a great gift, to renew our marriage vows to one another, to experience deep oneness and great pleasure. God intended sex to be mutually pleasurable. And if you doubt this, read Song of Songs. Trust me, in Song of Songs, sex is racy and it's graphic. I've read, it's sometimes it's veiled in poetry, but when you understand the original Hebrew, it's very graphic. There's a second thing I'm not saying. I'm also not saying that all forms of birth control are wrong. I believe birth control is okay as long as it doesn't cause abortions or doesn't permanently make it impossible for me to ever have children. But what's not okay is what people do in our culture by separating sex and marriage and children. Sex and marriage and children go together. And what Onan was doing was pursuing sex in a way that did not obligate him to Tamar. It didn't fulfill his family's responsibilities, and it didn't support God's plan to bless the world through a promised seed. Also, that he would not have to divide his inheritance with another brother. Onan was saying, sex, yes, marriage, no, children, no. And because of this, God cursed him, God judged him, God killed him. So, at this point, Judah's lost two sons to who were married to Tamar. And let's look at how he reasons through this situation in verse 11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. You see, rather than acknowledging his son's own wickedness and his own failure as a father, Judah became superstitious, believing instead that Tamar had somehow cursed his beloved sons. He didn't want to admit what a mess they were or what a mess he had been as a father. So rather than recognizing his own guilt and their guilt, he blames Tamar, who has been the victim of these evil husbands. In this, we see that Judah is selfish, and he's turned his back on Abraham's God-given vision of blessing. So he didn't give her his last son, fearing that he too might die. So Judah told Tamar to wait until his third son, Shelah, had grown up. But really, he had no intention of giving his third son to Tamar. And we'll see that as we progress through the passage. Now, Tamar was not free to remarry. Legally, she was part of Judah's family, but Judah had no plans for Tamar's inclusion. Now, it's important to understand that this put Tamar in a humanly impossible situation. Although it's hard to be a widow in any culture, in Tamar's culture, it was enormously difficult, especially a twice widow with no children. Every society has certain requirements for you to experience well-being, functionality, dignity, and inclusion. And in Tamar's world, this requirement was having a spouse and children. If she was unable to have that, she would be despised. She would be an outcast, someone who people looked down on, who people considered to be cursed by God and deserving of their contempt. If she were alive today, it would almost be as if instead of receiving a college degree, at graduation, there was a mix-up, and instead of a college degree, she became a registered sex offender. That's the difference it would make in what she could expect from her future. In this culture, having a spouse and children gave you great honor and purpose and allowed you to be a functional part of society. And it ensured that you would be provided for by your son and his portion of the inheritance. And that's one reason why the Bible is so enormously concerned with the welfare of widows. Look what it says in Psalm 146:9. The Lord watches over the sojourners. He upholds the widow and the fatherless, but the way of the wicked he brings to ruin. Then Isaiah 1:17. Learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, and plead the widow's cause. Then in Acts 6, we see that one of the first orders of business the early church engaged in was providing for widows. And then finally, James 1:27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Tamar has had two wicked husbands, both whom have died, and now she's left alone and childless with no hope of a future. And the man who is obligated to protect her, Judah, has violated his daughter-in-law by shirking his responsibilities, denying her the right to well-being and status within the community, instead shifting her problems onto others. Now, Tamar was legally entitled to bear the heir of Judah. That was her right, and it was being denied her by Judah. She is in a situation that is incredibly unjust, and there's no redress for a widow who was treated like this. She had been permanently sidelined. She's defenseless and has no legal recourse. So Tamar, a desperate widow, is stuck, and she needs a breakthrough, a way out of this limbo. And when Tamar sees a window of opportunity, she decisively jumps at it and courageously pursues it. Read with me in verse 12. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. And Judah was comforted. And when Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hurah the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He answered, "I will give you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "If you give me a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." And so he gave them to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, taking off her veil, and she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men by the road of the place, "Where's the colt prostitute who was at Enam by the road at the roadside?" And they said, "No colt prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Also, the men of this place said, "There is no colt prostitute here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her." So Tamar hears that Judah's wife has died, and she springs into action. She knows what kind of man Judah is, and she knows what he's going to want to do to cope. So she pretends she's a prostitute, and knowing Judah, she counts on the fact that if Judah sees a prostitute, he'll visit her. Now, what kind of man could you say that about? He's pretty far from God. And Judah has no way to pay her, so she asks him to give him his signet and cord and ring and staff. Now, this was a staff with a cylinder attached to it by a cord, and what you would do is it had Judah's seal on it. So he would roll it over clay or on wax to make legal agreements with others. So basically, it's the equivalent of him leaving his wallet with her. And when he sends payment, they can't find her. And at this point, Judah's only concerned with his reputation. Judah's like a reputable businessman or a gentleman who unwittingly loses his wallet in a brothel. And only his reputation concerns him. Let's continue reading in verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." And she was brought out, and she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant." And she said, "Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff." Then Judah identified them and said, "She is more righteous than I, because I did not give her my son Shelah." And he did not know her again. All right, now we're in a position to see our first point, Tamar's breakthrough. And that is, Tamar breaks through injustice. Now notice first the punishment that she faces. She's about to be burned alive. She knew what she was doing carried the possibility of immense risk. Second, notice the pronouncement Judah makes on her. He vindicates her, saying, "She is more righteous than I." In this story, Tamar is presented as having preserved the family line. In fact, Tamar is given the honor of being one of the only women listed in Jesus' genealogy. Although her methods were more than questionable, through courage, she was found worthy to be the distant grandmother of the Savior of the world. Now, I have to be honest. I am a little uncomfortable making this point from Tamar. It's not comfortable to use her as a positive example. After all, she used seduction and deception to get what she wanted. But as I've studied this passage, what I've discovered is that the Bible casts Tamar in a somewhat favorable light. When Judah sees the situation, he says, "She is more righteous than I." Righteous in Hebrew is the Hebrew word tzaddik, which literally means just. It's a judicial word, and it's being used judicially here. You see, as she's being dragged out to be burned alive, probably at the city gates where most judicial affairs were settled, she's being dragged out and she sends a message to Judah. And when he responds, he does so as a judge. And he determines that although what she did was wrong, her sin is mitigated by the enormous injustice that he has done to her. Judah looks at what he has done and what she is demanding, and he says that justice is on her side. Now, this is radical. The Bible's take on what Tamar has done is so far off the map, so far from what we'd expect. Sexual seduction and deception, was that right? Judah doesn't say she's righteous. No, he says she is more righteous than he is. Judas is saying, "I'm the one with the power," and that mitigates the situation. In some cases, a person who has been oppressed may do bad things, and they're still wrong. But in the wider context of the oppression, we need to be understanding. Their behavior is not excused, but the punishment is mitigated. It's kind of like what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 7:3. He says, "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" Notice, it's not that what she did wasn't wrong. There's a speck in her eye, but there's a log in Judah's eye. You see, Tamar brilliantly and ingeniously uses the double standard of Judah. Tamar committed the kind of sin that good people are quick to condemn, sexual sin. Judah committed the kind of sin that we tend to overlook, callousness and indifference to the helpless. Sometimes we look at sexual sin as the really bad sin, and we look at other sins like social injustice and callousness and pride as lesser offenses. So what can we learn from Tamar? Well, for one thing, social injustice is a big sin that must be met with courage. When God sees the haves who don't watch out and protect the have-nots, he calls that injustice. See, in Tamar's society, widows were the have-nots. And to some extent, that's still true today. In fact, in some parts of the world, it's exactly the true. The widows had no voice, no support. They were oppressed and downtrodden. And God calls us to pursue justice on behalf of the have-nots, to be concerned with their plight. A month or two ago, I came upon a letter written by St. Augustine in AD 428. And this letter describes something amazing. In this letter, Augustine is talking about the increase of slave trafficking by abduction in North Africa. And he describes how groups of Christians raided slave ships to set prisoners free. Listen to what he writes in this letter. "About 4 months ago, before I wrote this letter, a crowd of people collected from different regions, but particularly from Numidia, that's North Africa, were brought here by Galatian merchants to be transported from the shores of Hippo. However, a faithful Christian was at hand who was aware of our practice of performing acts of mercy in such cases, and he brought the news to the church, and immediately about 120 people were set free by us. some from the ship which they had to board, others from the place where they had been hidden before putting on board. We discovered that barely six of these had been sold by their parents. On hearing about the misfortunes that had led to the rest of them to the Galatians via their abductors and kidnappers, hardly one of us could restrain their tears. Can you imagine? What are you guys doing after church today? Going to a restaurant for lunch, taking a nap, doing some light shopping? We're mounting an armed rescue mission to free captive slaves. This is a good reminder that Christians are called to action. If we want our lives to truly demonstrate our beliefs, then we should actively engage in acts of mercy and justice. What would it mean for us or our small group or our group of friends to get together and raid a slave ship? Who is in need of justice that we are capable of supplying? Who is the widow in your life? The church must always be about social justice because the church is about God, and God is about justice. God is about caring for the oppressed and the alone and the destitute. He cares for children and the weak and the helpless, and so must we. In 1 John 3:16, it says this: "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart to him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." We are to pursue justice courageously on the behalf of the have-nots. Maybe it's speaking up for the unborn who don't have a voice. Or maybe it's helping the poor in Haiti or Tijuana or San Diego or here in Temecula. Or maybe it's standing up against human trafficking. Or maybe it's helping an elderly neighbor who doesn't have family support. Whatever it is, let's courageously stand up for those who don't have a voice, for the marginalized, for the weak, for the poor and the oppressed. Because the truth is, Christ stood up for us when we were poor, and he made us rich in him. I recently read an excellent book on social justice called When Helping Hurts by Steve Corbett and Brian Fickert. And the point I thought was just radical. The point I expected them to make is that sometimes, when not done wisely and appropriately, trying to help poor people can actually end up hurting them. And so you've heard that people say that when you see a guy standing on the side of the road, it's not wise to give them money, because what you can end up doing is fueling the addiction that led to their homelessness in the first place. And that was the point I expected them to make. And they did. But then they took it a step further that I didn't expect. The more radical point was that if you want to help someone, to really give someone justice, then you have to enter a relationship with them where you'll experience their hurt with them. You have to embrace your own mutual brokenness rather than thinking of ourselves as superior to the poor. Otherwise, you'll just end up exacerbating the problem by reinforcing their feelings of weakness and inferiority. Only when helping hurts you, when it gets messy and sacrificial and involves real relationships, only then does it really, truly help. And that's what Jesus did, isn't it? He became a man and fully entered into our experience to restore us to relationship with God. He was hurt to help us, and that's what we ought to do. So Tamar pursued justice, even at great risk to her own life. She broke through from injustice to justice, and we ought to do the same. So that's the first breakthrough. Now let's look at the second. Judah also has a breakthrough, but in quite a different way. Throughout this text, we've seen that Judah is pretty much a scumbag. In fact, this text is purposefully contrasting Judah's sinful lifestyle with Joseph's godly lifestyle. It's interesting when you look at this chapter that it's sandwiched into the Joseph story, and the entire rest of Genesis is focused on Joseph. The previous chapter was focused on Joseph. And in the next chapter, we're going to see where Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Joseph. But Joseph is different from Judah. He's a godly man. Joseph refuses immoral sex with Potiphar's wife and flees, leaving his cloak behind, which is later used to identify him. Judah welcomes the invitation of a prostitute and willingly leaves his staff and his seal behind as a guarantee of payment. And in both stories, an item is brought out that identifies each of them. In Joseph's story, the cloak confirms a false accusation. In Judah's story, the staff and seal confirm a true accusation. Potiphar's wife accuses Joseph of making her a joke. Judah actually becomes a joke by his act of immorality. So Judah stands in stark contrast to Joseph. And when Judah finds out that Tamar is pregnant, we see that he is ruthless and hypocritical. When someone tells him that Tamar has prostituted herself and is pregnant, his response is incredibly hateful. In Hebrew, it's only two words, take and burn. And burning alive was a punishment that was reserved only for the most heinous of crimes. This punishment is far beyond the scope of what Tamar committed. It shows utter contempt for Tamar. You see, Judah was about to burn her alive. And when you do something that despicable, that will change you. You'll either spend the rest of your life hiding from the horrible truth of what you've done, or you'll admit it. Every human heart needs to shift blame, needs to justify itself. And that's what Judah's doing here. Rather than admitting that he'd failed as a father and that his sons were evil, he's about to burn this young woman to death. And then we see something happen in verse 25 as Tamar's about to be brought out. She sends message to Judah. Read with me in verse 25 again. It says, "And as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, 'Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' Tamar sends his stuff to him and asks, 'Do you recognize this?'" The Hebrew phrase for "identify this" or "do you recognize this" is "haker na." And it's an important phrase in this text. It means to make a correct decision as a judge. It means to discern and know, and not just to know, but to acknowledge and respect. It's the same word that was used in the previous chapter when Jacob is asked to identify Joseph's coat. The brothers come up and ask, "Do you recognize this coat? Haker na?" It's the same word used later in Genesis when it says that Joseph's brothers don't recognize him in Egypt when they're asking him for food and he's the ruler of all Egypt. So Tamar asks him, "Do you recognize this staff and the signet? Do you recognize the symbol of yourself?" But she's asking more than that. She's asking him, "Do you see the sexual hypocrisy? Do you see the delusion? Do you see where you're headed? Do you see where you're at?" And he does. He responds with, "She is more righteous than I." This is Judah's breakthrough. Judah breaks through a hard, selfish heart. And this breakthrough took the recognition of his own self-centeredness. This is Judah's spiritual awakening, his rebirth. And that rebirth occurs when, like Judah, you come to see that the people that you despise, you're no better than they are. Who is it that you despise? What type of person do you look down on and have contempt for? What sin really disgusts you and gets to you and makes you feel like physically hurting someone? What sin is it that makes you want to burn someone down? You are no better than they are. Isaiah 64:6 says, "We have all together become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a polluted garment. We fade like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind take us away." You see, Judah needed Tamar to point out this hypocritical sin in his own life that he couldn't even see. The sin in your life, the flaw, the character quality that is most hurting you and the people around you is probably the one you can't see. The sin that has the most power over you is probably the one you don't even know is there. And you're not looking for it. Your only hope is that through the Tamars of this world, and maybe through other awful, painful things, God would reveal it to you and set it before you and say, "Do you recognize this?" We need the initiating grace of God. Hebrews 3:13 says this. It says, "But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." Sin is deceitful.
And so we need God to use us in each other's lives to hold us up like a mirror to each other and say, do you recognize this? Do you see what's going on? This publicly humiliated Judah, but he was on his way to truly being lost. It wasn't an easy recognition. It must have been painful and embarrassing. But when sheep are being found, they don't feel like they're being found. When lost sheep are being loved, they don't feel like they're being loved. When lost sheep are saved, they don't feel like they're being saved. It's hard and painful. All recognition of sin is hard and painful. But it's better than continuing under the burden of sin. And I believe that for Judah, this recognition was the beginning of a change that continued in his life. This was the first in a series of spiritual awakenings for Judah. If you look later in Genesis, Judah is a different kind of person. We don't have time to look at it completely, but if you look in the last chapter, Judah sold Joseph into slavery. But in chapter 44, rather than give another brother to be taken hostage by Joseph, instead he offers to give himself. He says, now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy, as the servant said to my Lord, and let the boy go back to with his brothers. Judah's a different man after this. At the end of Genesis, Judah is given the birthright of his father, and Jacob tells Judah that he will rule over all of his brothers. In fact, from Judah would come the ruler of Israel, King David, and eventually the king of the universe, the Lord Jesus. Judah is the distant father of Jesus. In fact, Jesus himself is called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah in Revelation 5:5. And if that wasn't an honor enough, in Revelation 21:12, we see that when God redeems creation and creates a new heaven and a new earth, Judah's name will be permanently inscribed on one of the heavenly gates of the heavenly city of Jerusalem for all eternity. And that came about because Judah had a breakthrough that took the recognition of his own hardened, sinful, selfish heart. So we've seen two breakthroughs, but we need to look at one more to finish this story. And that final breakthrough has to do with the child of Judah and Tamar. Read with me in verse 27, because we see the outcome of their actions. When the time of the labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread to his hand, saying, this one came out first. But he drew it back. He drew back his hand, and behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore, his name was called Perez. After his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, his name was called Zerah. Now, as we read this story, immediately a number of things become clear. First, this birth is reminiscent of Jacob's birth, the baby's grandfather. Both births involve twins, in this case, Perez and Zerah, in Jacob's case, Jacob and Esau. In both births, the younger thrusts ahead of the elder and displaces him, taking the birthright. In both births, the displaced child is associated with the color red. Zerah has a red string tied around his wrist. In Esau's case, Genesis 25:25 says the first came out red, all his body like a hairy coat. So they called his name Esau. So once again, we see that God is sovereign and is guiding history towards his intended goal. Just as God sovereignly chose Jacob to carry his royal line, so now God chooses Perez. You see, God is hardly mentioned in this chapter, except when he's killing Judah's sons. But this birth at the end shows that God has been sovereignly ordaining this child to come about all along. In reality, Tamar didn't break through injustice, and Judah didn't break through his hard, selfish heart. God did. God is the one who has been at work in this family, and their evil actions could not thwart his sovereign plan. This family looks dysfunctional, but God's got it under control. He rules and is guiding this family towards their divine destiny. So once again, God chooses the younger to rule over the older. And this foreshadows what's about to happen in Genesis, when Joseph's elder brothers will kneel before him and he will rule over them. But it also points to something bigger. It points to the younger brother who was yet to be born when this was written, to the one who will ultimately rule over all of the Israel and the entire universe, to King Jesus. He would be the youngest son from this lineage, the one towards whom all the blessings have been pointing, and yet he would rule over all of the elder brothers that he came from. You see, Perez means breakthrough. And that's what this story is about. Not how you can live a good life, but instead how God breaks through our oppression and our injustice, our hardened, sinful hearts, and into our lives. And now we know that God would ultimately break into this world in the person of Jesus of Nazareth and would break through the chains that bound us, triumphing over them by the cross. You see, through this child, through Perez, eventually King Jesus would come. Look at the genealogy in Matthew 1. Matthew 1, verses 2 and 3. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez, and by Zerah, and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and right on down to the Messiah. Notice here that Tamar is named. This is important. The fact that Tamar, a Gentile, is the mother of this child is important because it shows us that there's hope for the Gentiles. They have a place in God's plan of blessing. God's plan of blessing is not just for Israel, it's for the entire world, for all the nations. You see, Tamar is one of four women named in Matthew's genealogy. And all these women have a few things in common. First, they're all Gentiles, meaning they all come from outside Israel. Tamar and Rahab are Canaanites, Ruth is a Moabite, and Bathsheba is a Hittite. In fact, Matthew's gospel is bookended with Gentiles, beginning here in the genealogy and then at the end in the Great Commission, where he tells us to preach the gospel to all nations. Second, each of these women have a highly irregular and potentially scandalous marriage union, which foreshadows the birth of Christ to Mary, which was both irregular and caused a scandal. And third, each of these women exercised faith. And by that faith, God deemed them worthy to carry the child of promise. So this story concludes with a note of hope. Hope that God is in control and is steering us towards his intended goal, even when life around us seems dysfunctional. Hope that God would bless the Gentiles with all our flaws and imperfections through faith. And hope that his son would break into this world and would save us and bless us with a relationship with himself. And one day, Jesus will again break into this world. And he'll shatter all injustice and all sinful hard hearts once and for all. And then we'll begin the great adventure of spending eternity with him. Let's pray. Lord, we are grateful that you are a God of breakthroughs. Lord, that you broke into this world to redeem us, people who were lost and hopeless and stuck. Thank you so much for saving us and loving us and caring for us. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to be your hands and your feet on this earth, to spread your justice, and help us, Lord, to confront our own hard and selfish hearts. Help us to see clearly. Lord, help us to see that sin that is weighing us down, and may we turn from it and honor you with our lives. We love you and we praise you, and thank you for your mercy to us. In Jesus' name, amen.